Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence, this Tuesday, August 25th, 2026, for our Commodities and Energy edition.
Today's thesis examines the escalating friction between sovereign fiscal policy and global supply stability, specifically how new tariff regimes are fundamentally decoupling cost structures from traditional trade assumptions. We are moving away from a period of predictable integration toward a fragmented landscape of localized, high-cost energy dependencies.
So the era of cheap, frictionless global trade is officially over.
And that volatility begins with the structural shifts in the macro regime, where rising debt levels and new trade barriers are creating unprecedented fiscal friction.
We start by looking at how these mounting tariffs and shifting debt dynamics are reshaping the global macro landscape. The U.S. national debt has officially crossed the $40 trillion mark, and apparently the Treasury is trying to manage the sheer weight of it by treating the long-term debt market like a high-frequency trading desk. Today we're looking at fiscal friction, the collision of massive debt, aggressive new tariffs, and a Federal Reserve that's caught between a rock and a hard place.
It's a massive structural shift, Maya. We're seeing the Treasury, under Secretary Scott Bessent, essentially attempting a mini QE by pivoting issuance away from long-term bonds toward shorter-term Treasury bills to suppress the 10-year yield. The goal is to manage the bond vigilante sentiment, but it's creating a massive drain on global liquidity as the government tries to retire duration by flooding the market with short-term paper.
So instead of fixing the leak in the boat, we're just frantically throwing smaller, more frequent buckets of water at the floor.
The data tells a story that Band-Aid approach has a massive hidden cost. If we stay in this regime of high inflation, driven by things like the 28% peak tariffs we saw recently and energy supply shocks, the cost to service that short-term debt will explode. We're already seeing a structural primary deficit of 2% of GDP, which is being compounded by the fact that interest payments alone now consume 4% of our GDP. It's a trajectory where debt servicing is starting to outpace even our defense spending.
Which is great, because nothing says economic stability like a budget that prioritizes paying interest over actually protecting the country.
It's even more complex because of the crowding out effect happening in the capital markets. You have the massive, unprecedented capital expenditures required for the AI buildout. We're talking about a $400 billion requirement for the AI complex alone, competing for the exact same pool of capital as sovereign debt. This massive volume of long-dated corporate issuance, especially in the investment-grade sector, is fundamentally altering the supply-demand dynamics of the entire global credit market.
So the AI revolution is basically an expensive roommate that's constantly outbidding the government for the best parts of the economy.
In a sense, yes. And it's creating a very specific type of inflation.
We aren't just looking at a wage price spiral, we're looking at supply-side inflation from tariffs and industrial reshoring. Bloomberg Surveillance noted that the U.S. bond market is increasingly exhibiting the characteristics of a developing market, with heightened volatility and uncertainty as debt-to-GDP ratios climb toward 120%. When the fundamental question becomes who will be a reliable buyer of U.S. debt, you start seeing the kind of instability typically found in much less mature economies.
I love that. We've officially graduated from global reserve power to emerging market volatility, the upgrade.
It's a high-stakes game of musical chairs. On one side, you have the hyperscalers, the massive tech firms building out data centers, issuing huge amounts of debt to fund infrastructure. On the other, you have the Treasury trying to manage a $10.4 trillion debt rollover. And then there's the shadow credit problem. The primary systemic risk to the financial system isn't even traditional bank credit anymore. It's the opaque growth of shadow credit and aggregate money supply that we can no longer accurately track via M3 or M4 metrics.
Wait, so you're telling me the people in charge of the money supply don't actually know how much money is in the supply?
It's getting much harder to see through the fog. But if you look at the commodity side of this friction, the inflation is very real. We're seeing a debasement trade emerging. For instance, Patrick Armstrong suggested that investors looking to hedge against this debasement should favor gold miners over just holding gold or Bitcoin to capture the nominal earnings growth from rising commodity prices.
And that brings us to the energy-intensive part of this AI boom. Everyone is talking about the picks and shovels of AI, the chips and the software, but no one is talking about the massive, hungry power plants required to keep these data centers running.
That's where the friction hits the physical world. We're seeing a massive structural pull-up in long-term interest rates because the demand for long-duration capital is being driven by this energy-intensive infrastructure. But the supply side is incredibly fragile. Look at the recent 10% decrease in global refining capacity caused by drone strikes on Russian refineries. This isn't a shortage of crude oil. It's a shortage of the ability to turn that oil into usable diesel and gasoline. That crack spread is a massive inflationary driver.
So we have a new normal of high inflation, high debt, and high energy costs, all wrapped up in a shiny AI-powered bow.
It's a new normal of 6.5% nominal GDP growth, but that growth is heavily K-shaped. As Ben Harris argued on Macro Musings, we have to view AI-driven productivity through a half-effectiveness lens. For every dollar of deficit reduction we project from AI efficiency, the idiosyncratic costs, like increased healthcare spending from AI-enabled longevity or higher equilibrium interest rates from capital demand, will likely negate 50% of that benefit.
So the productivity miracle is basically a treadmill that just runs faster every time we try to catch up.
There's a signal here. We're in a regime where the traditional 60-40 portfolio is broken because rising yields are now correlated with falling stock prices. We've moved from the great moderation to a temperamental era. If you're an investor, you can't just sit on a balanced fund and hope for the best. You have to find the specific points of tension, like the mid-cap industrials that are actually building the physical infrastructure or the energy producers who can navigate this new protectionist landscape.
Investors in the infrastructure and industrial sectors need to look past the software hype and focus on the actual physical capacity of the supply chain.
Watch the 30-year Treasury yield. If it breaches the 5% threshold, it could fundamentally break the current valuation models for the entire S&P 500.
But all this structural tension in the West is about to hit a very literal bottleneck in the East. I don't know, Alex. Every time we talk about geopolitical choke points, it sounds like a very expensive way of saying we're all just one rogue drone away from a gas station crisis. Why are we acting like the global energy market is this fragile glass sculpture when, frankly, the price of Brent seems remarkably unbothered by all this chaos?
Because the chaos isn't hitting the price of crude directly, it's hitting the plumbing. We are seeing a massive decoupling where the raw commodity remains relatively stable, but the logistics of moving it are fracturing. If you look at the Strait of Hormuz, the issue isn't that the oil has vanished, but that the mechanism of transit is being intentionally throttled.
Throttled? That is a lovely, polite way of saying Iran is playing a high-stakes game of it's not a blockade, it's a negotiation.
Argus Media noted that Iran is effectively using the strait as a pressure release valve for negotiations, selectively allowing certain cargoes, like Iraqi crude via Sinnaker tankers, to pass, while actively striking ad hoc tankers to signal that the current level of maritime freedom is unsustainable. They aren't trying to shut the door, they are trying to make the door too expensive to open.
So they aren't sinking every ship in sight, they're just making the insurance paperwork a nightmare.
Two things stand out. They are creating what some analysts call neighborhood criminality, using targeted strikes on vessels like those from ADNOC to drive up maritime insurance rates, and use economic deterrence to achieve a blockade without a full-scale naval war. It's a threshold-based strategy. They want to keep throughput capped at around 10 to 12 million barrels per day to avoid the massive escalation we saw when the IMO evacuation plan hit 40 million.
But if the ships are still moving and the price is hovering around $90, where is the structural squeeze everyone keeps predicting?
The squeeze is happening in the middle of the supply chain, not at the wellhead. Unhedged reported that the market is currently operating in a state of informational blindness because ships in the Strait of Hormuz have actually disabled their transponders to avoid Iranian missile strikes. Traders can't even verify if the flow is the 9 million barrels per day the U.S. Energy Secretary claims, or as low as 5 or 6 million. We are flying blind.
So we're basically trading based on satellite photos and vibes. That's not a market, that's a guessing game.
It's even more granular than that. The real crisis isn't a crude shortage, it's a refining crunch. We are seeing a massive contraction in refining capacity because of drone strikes and geopolitical shifts. This has led to a terrifying decoupling where the supply of raw oil looks okay, but the specific molecules we need are disappearing. Doomer pointed out that the U.S. diesel crack spread surged to triple digits, peaking at $102 per barrel just last Monday, August 18th. We have plenty of oil, but we don't have enough diesel, gasoline, or jet fuel because the refineries are being hit or bypassed.
And I suppose the Black Sea and the Caspian are part of this plumbing failure too.
Worth noting, it's a global contagion of infrastructure risk. Look at the Caspian Pipeline Consortium. Back in November 2025, Ukrainian drones targeted the terminal at the port of Novorossiysk, specifically damaging mooring too. When you hit a node like that, you aren't just hitting Russia, you are hitting the entire flow of Kazakh energy to the global market. It proves that modern conflict can bypass borders to strike critical energy conduits thousands of miles from the actual frontline.
It sounds like we're moving away from a world of open seas and toward a world of toll roads, where whoever controls the narrowest strip of water holds the remote control for the global economy.
That's exactly the fear. We're seeing the potential collapse of the grand bargain, the idea that the U.S. provides naval protection in exchange for energy stability and dollar dominance. As the U.S. Navy's presence is questioned, we see a shift toward fragmented, regionalized commodity flows. Even the U.S. Treasury is trying to intervene by targeting the Iran-China oil corridor with new sanctions, as noted by CTVC, aiming to cut off the lifelines for Chinese teapot refineries.
It's a massive, expensive game of whack-a-mole. You sanction one corridor, and the oil just finds a new, more expensive, and much more dangerous way to get to the pump.
And the cost of that whack-a-mole is being passed directly to the consumer. Bloomberg surveillance highlighted how this volatility is creating a widening economic divide. In the U.S., we can absorb a $90 barrel, but in import-dependent nations like the Philippines, these fuel costs are becoming so extreme they are actually forcing people into localized shifts toward work-from-home models just to avoid the cost of commuting.
So the tolls on these maritime highways are eventually going to be paid by the person trying to drive to work.
Stepping back, if the current trend of episodic escalation continues, we aren't just looking at higher prices, we are looking at a fundamental restructuring of how global energy is distributed. We could see a permanent removal of millions of barrels from the market, creating a long-term bullish floor that no amount of U.S. production can easily break.
Investors in the tanker and refining sectors need to stop looking at crude production numbers and start obsessing over transponder signals and peer stability.
And keep a very close eye on any significant move by China into the distressed shipping market, because that could turn a manageable squeeze into a total global disruption.
But if we can't even trust the data on how much oil is moving, how are we supposed to power the massive new surge in electricity demand coming from the world's growing appetite for AI and massive data centers? I was reading about a town in Michigan called Salini, population about 3,000, that recently had to settle a lawsuit with Oracle and OpenAI over zoning. It sounds like a plot from a dystopian comedy where a handful of villagers successfully sues the gods of the cloud.
It's less comedy and more a signal of a massive structural shift in the AI industry. We're moving away from the era of software as a service, which was essentially low debt and infinitely scalable, into a regime of physical scarcity. As Odlotz noted, the industry is transitioning into a heavy infrastructure model where the real bottlenecks aren't just algorithms, but land, water, and power.
The cloud is actually just a very thirsty, very hungry collection of concrete and copper.
The pattern is clear that hunger is creating a massive supply chain bottleneck. Bloomberg Surveillance reported that the hyperscaler capital expenditure cycle has shifted from a purely financial trend to a physical one, where the availability of construction labor, concrete, and power is now the primary constraint on growth. It's no longer just about having the cash to build, it's about having the physical atoms to execute.
Which sounds like a nightmare for anyone trying to keep their electricity bill from doubling. I assume the local utility companies aren't exactly throwing a parade for these massive new data centers.
They're actually quite terrified of the stranded cost risk. CTVC by Sightline Climate highlighted that regulators in Georgia are scrutinizing massive energy contracts, like OpenAI's $20 billion Project Camellia. The fear is that if these massive industrial users exit their agreements prematurely, the local ratepayers, the regular people, will be left holding the bill for all the new transmission lines and substations.
We're essentially subsidizing the infrastructure for big tech's next big move, and if they decide to move their servers to, say, a more friendly nuclear grid in France, we're stuck with the bill.
That's the affordability trap. If regulators cap utility rates to protect consumers, they inadvertently starve the grid of the very investment needed for the energy transition. This is why we're seeing a total inversion of the power dynamic. In the 2023 to 2025 period, developers were asking, what can the community offer us? Now, as Odlotz pointed out, it has become, what can we offer the community to allow us in?
Which, based on the news out of Texas and New York, isn't much. Even leaders like Greg Abbott and Kathy Hochul are hitting the brakes.
It's becoming a bipartisan NIMBY movement. The issue isn't even about the technology's existential risks anymore. It's about the immediate, tangible strain on local transformers and the last mile of the grid. We are seeing a massive, global search for compute capacity in places like Canada and Australia, specifically to bypass these U.S. political and regulatory constraints.
It's a high-stakes game of musical chairs, but the chairs are made of high-voltage transformers and they're all running out of space.
And the cost of those chairs is driving up the entire stack.
Energy regulators in Georgia will have to decide if they can absorb the risk of Project Camellia without breaking the residential rate structure. Keep an eye on the next round of state-level utility commission elections, because the voters there will decide if the grid gets an upgrade or an anchor. But as this struggle for power intensifies, it's also shaking up the very ingredients we use to build our modern world, specifically in the metals and chemicals markets. We're looking at a massive tug-of-war today in the commodities space. On one side, you have these persistent, localized supply shocks, and on the other, a global demand that seems to be hitting a brick wall. So, Alex, in this battle of cracks in commodities, which side are you betting on?
It depends on which molecule you're trading, Maya, but the tension is definitely tightening. In the polymer markets, we're seeing a move toward threshold-based volatility. For instance, while European August contracts for polyethylene rose by 55 euros compared to July, the real story is the logistics-driven supply constraints. We've seen drone attacks on ships in the Black Sea and ongoing risks in the Bab el-Mandeb acting as a price floor, even when demand is weak.
Even if nobody wants to buy the plastic, the fact that it's harder to move it makes it more expensive. A delightful way to run a business.
And it's not just shipping. In the methanol sector, the landscape has shifted violently since the expiration of the US-Iran Memorandum of Understanding on August 17th. As Dave McCaskill noted, the loss of Iranian flows with only a handful of units operational is creating extreme uncertainty. We're looking at a massive demand destruction phase, with 2026 demand projected to drop by 3 million tons compared to 2025, largely because China's MTO operating rates have plummeted to 30 or 40%.
So the Middle East is tightening supply, and China is effectively turning off the lights on consumption. It feels like a recipe for a very quiet, very expensive market.
It's a mismatch. While methanol demand is cratering, the metals side is all about decoupling. In the battery chain, the focus is on breaking China's 70% grip on lithium refining. Companies like Electrolith are pushing technologies like DLER to enable localized refining in the US and Chile. Argus Media highlights that this isn't just about tech, it's about the water advantage, using electrodialysis to operate with zero process water in arid regions like the Atacama.
It sounds like everyone is trying to build a fortress around their own supply chains.
The implication runs deeper. Whether it's the regulatory clarity gap delaying chemical recycling investments in Europe, or the strategic shift in US polyethylene from contract declines to export-driven surges, the era of seamless global flow is being replaced by localized strategic buffers.
Investors in European circular polymers need to finalize their investment decisions within the next 18 months to hit those 2030 targets. Keep an eye on the next round of Middle East shipping data to see if those ghost supplies of methanol actually materialize. But as we look at these heavy industrial shifts, how do we transition into the world of organic growth and the next generation of energy storage? I spent my morning staring at a carton of pea protein, wondering if I'm basically eating expensive garden mulch.
Well, if we look at the shifts in the bioeconomy, that's about to get a lot more efficient. The industry is moving toward a full-stack model where companies like Planetary aren't just building massive, $150 million standalone plants, but are instead licensing technology to co-locate production within existing sugar mills.
So instead of building new factories, we're just turning old sugar mills into high-tech protein labs, turning molasses into meat, and eventually, I assume, turning the leftover sludge into plastic straws and designer textiles.
By utilizing the entire sucrose value chain, moving from high-purity sugar to lower-value juices and molasses, producers can drive extreme cost competitiveness because those precursors require much less energy to process into fermentable substrates.
It sounds great, until you realize we might need to quadruple global sugar production to keep the lights on in these biorefineries.
That is the massive mass and energy balance challenge. But while we solve the feedstock side, the energy side is seeing a massive scale-up in storage. Per Gerard Reed, we're seeing a shift toward a multi-layered buffer architecture where LFP battery technology, which already holds 95% of the stationary storage market, is being integrated into everything from the chip level in data centers to the grid itself.
It's all very Lego-like, isn't it? Just clicking more batteries into the grid until the intermittency disappears.
It's about duration. We're moving from 2-hour peak shaving to 12-hour stability to prevent the kind of grid meltdowns that threaten new data center expansions. However, the biofuel sector is facing a much harder reality. Argus Media reports that the 2025 transition to the 45Z tax credit created a lost year of production paralysis, and they project the RIN bank will enter a period of structural insolvency by early 2027 as supply vanishes.
U.S. refinery regulators need to decide if they're going to let the RIN bank hit zero or intervene before the paper blending stops, masking the actual shortage. Keep an eye on the next EPA SRE decision, because if it triggers another massive release of credits, the entire pricing signal for renewable diesel could evaporate overnight. As we close out this edition, the throughline of this week's briefing is the inescapable return of physical constraints. We are moving away from a world of frictionless digital efficiency and into an era where the cloud is increasingly defined by the tangible, the copper in the ground, the throughput in the Strait of Hormuz, and the massive electrical load of new data centers. The era of low-cost, borderless energy and commodities is being replaced by a landscape of localized, high-premium bottlenecks.
So here's the picture. The most critical implication here is for the capital allocators and industrial planners in the US and EU. For years, the strategy was simply to scale software and services. But as the Treasury's debt servicing costs climb and the energy requirements for projects like Project Camellia intensify, the calculus for the next decade of infrastructure must shift. You can no longer build a digital empire without first securing the physical atoms. If you aren't hedging against the rising cost of energy-intensive logistics and the shrinking global refining capacity, your digital margins will be eroded by the very physicality required to sustain them.
It's a fundamental shift from managing code to managing scarcity.
It's a telling detail. So as you navigate the markets next week, keep a close eye on the 30-year Treasury yields. If we see those yields break decisively above the 5% threshold, it won't just be a signal for bond traders. It will be the moment that fundamentally invalidates the current valuation models for the entire heavy infrastructure and AI growth complex. That is the threshold that confirms the new high-cost reality is officially here.
Thank you for joining us for this weekly digest. We'll see you next Tuesday.